The opinions and views expressed in this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents.
And good morning and welcome to this April 18th, 2018 edition of Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting to you live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org. We are always available via podcast. You can follow us on iTunes. We're under College Radio. You can find us on Facebook. You can follow us on Twitter. There is actually really no reasons not to listen to us. And I think I mentioned this last time, but we this month are celebrating 20 years on the air. So if you do the math, 52 weeks, usually two authors a week, sometimes one. It's a lot of interviews up there for you to listen to. I'm your host for the hour, Marie Stone. We are doing what we do every Wednesday morning, which is chat with authors about their books, about their process, about their craft. The days when I have the luxury of one author for the entire hour are some of my very favorites. We get to take a deep dive into the book, and nothing more thrilling to welcome Joan Silber back to our show. She was on with me in 2013 for her book Fools. She is back with me now. Joan Silber is the author of the story collection Fools, which was long listed for the National Book Award and nominated for the Penn Faulkner Award. Her first novel, Household Words, won the Penn Hemingway Award. She has published five other books of fiction, including Ideas of Heaven, A Ring of Stories, a finalist for the National Book Award and the Story Prize, and The Size of the World, a finalist for the Los Angeles Times Prize in Fiction and one of the Seattle Times 10 Best Books of Fiction. She's a recipient of a Guggenheim, grants for the National Endowment of the Arts, the New York Foundation of the Arts. Her work has appeared all over, including the Paris Review, the New Yorker, Plowshares, elsewhere. And today we are going to talk about her latest book. I'm kind of reading through her other bio to see if her bio is so long. She's done so many amazing things. But today we're going to talk about her novel Improvement, which was published this last November. I'm pleased to report it did win the National Book Critics Circle Award and the Penn Faulkner Award. It's published by Counterpoint. She's also the author, and I want to talk about this with her. You know that there's a Grey Wolf series that we've done several of these little The Art Of series. And she did The Art of Time in Fiction. So I'd love to be able to talk with her about that, too. Joan, welcome back on.
Oh, thank you. I'm happy to be here.
That was overwhelming as I'm looking at everything. And I'm like, man, that's you're a busy woman. That's wonderful. So first and foremost, congratulations on the well-deserved success of this novel. This is wonderful. Could you feel it as you were writing it that this one was clicking in and was really going to connect with people?
No. I have to say, I was worried because the last three books I did before this were linked stories, and I really felt I'd done my best work in that form, but I wanted to write a novel next. I didn't want to keep doing the same thing. And I thought that, you know, the advantage of linked stories is that if you have a general idea, you know, you can get material for one story from the other, sort of. And you can think them up different ways, and you don't have to plan it all in advance. And I sort of thought I could do a novel that way, you know, at this stage of my life. Mm-hmm. And, of course, famous last words. It was much harder than I thought. It involved much more moving around and revising than I thought. And so I wasn't so confident about it when it was done. I liked it, but I was wary about it.
Well, you're going to hate my next question, which is, I know we're calling it a novel, but because I'm such a fanatic for the short story form, I still was tempted to look at these as I've looked at some of your other works as linked stories. I think Kierkegaard called it a kaleidoscopic story cycle.
Yeah, that was my first review. And yeah. I was fine with that. I mean, who minds being called the kaleidoscope of anything?
Right.
So, no, I'm totally fine with that. And in some ways, my heart is in the story form also. I think there's a way, I think one of the reasons this one has done well is because, you know, there's a question that's posed in the beginning that gets answered in some way by the end, and that's the satisfaction that you get with novels. But otherwise, it's definitely, pieces of it were published separately, and I'm happy to think of them as stories.
Yeah. Well, take us into it and kind of give us the world of Improvement for those who haven't picked it up yet so we can get introduced to these characters and kind of the scope of the book.
Well, it begins with an aunt and a niece and Denise, who's really the narrating character through important parts of it. She's young. She has a kid who's four. She's a single mom. She lives in New York in Harlem. She has a boyfriend who happens to be at Rikers Island, the New York prison, for a couple of months for selling a small amount of marijuana. And when he comes out of prison, we like the boyfriend. He's actually a good guy. I like him anyway.
Yeah.
He gets involved in selling cigarettes. Apparently, I don't smoke anymore, so I wouldn't know this, but half the cigarettes in New York are sold under the counter for a lower amount because the New York tax is so high. If you sneak up cigarettes from a low-tax state like Virginia, they're much cheaper. So she gets involved with that with very complicated circumstances that lead to the sort of accidental death of one of the characters. In the meantime, she has a very sort of redoubtable aunt, Kiki, who has a past in which she, as a sort of young, adventurous person of the 70s, was married to also a good guy in Turkey. And she has a whole past in Turkey that gets folded into the story. And she's also a kind of model for her niece, Reina, of a kind of self-reliance.
I love it. And really, those characters are the impetus, but then they don't fall away, but they, you know, other characters kind of pick up and start singing their songs in later stories, which is why I thought of these as more linked short stories. I love that we got to, you know, pick up on the tangent and say, oh, that this is how this person's action over here affected this person's life. It's so great. Tell me about the point of, not the point of entry into the novel specifically, but for you, what the hook was, if it was a character, if it was a set of circumstances, if it was a theme, what led you into this book?
Well, one of the hooks for me was during Hurricane Sandy, which I guess was 2012, part of New York was knocked out, including my part. They hit, you know, the tower that had our electrical lines in it. And the storm hit the tower. On the news, I heard a report of people in a housing project who are actually in Brooklyn who were elderly residents of this big high-rise housing project who were doing fine without electricity. They didn't know what the big fuss was about. And so the kind of self-reliance of those characters sort of rang some bells in my head because I'm always interested in that as an attribute. So I ended up putting Kiki into the hurricane and having her, I put her into the East Village, which is one of the affected areas. And I wanted to sort of show how she dealt with it and what her niece made of that. And also how it reflected back to, she lives in the countryside in Turkey in the 70s when she doesn't have electricity either. So I wanted to get that sense of how people manage, you know, what, not only skills, but internal resources they have in dealing with stuff. So that was my way into the story initially.
And did this start out as a short story? Because I know the first chapter was published independently in Tin House and then went on for the Best American Short Stories. And so was that idea that it was just going to be a story and then it kind of ballooned into more?
Yes, exactly. I thought it was going to be a story and then it seemed to sort of, you know, I thought of other things, and then it began. Once I had other ideas for what was going to happen with this cigarette smuggling, then it kind of bloomed further.
I love that the cigarettes, I was going to get into this later, but the cigarettes become, and tobacco and lung cancer become kind of a theme throughout. And I was wondering if that was intentional, that you, you know, gripped onto this idea of cigarette smuggling and then watched that play out, or if the book was done and you look back over it and say, huh, that's interesting. That, you know, my subconscious mind produced this kind of resonant theme that threaded itself throughout the book.
There are things that's true of in the book. I didn't realize that smuggling was recurring at other points and so forth. Yeah. But the cigarette stuff I did on purpose. So when you have a character who's tending someone who has lung cancer. It's not even that on purpose might be too strong a word. It's more that one idea kicks into another. So when I was putting characters in Richmond, which is where they smuggle stuff from, and since it's a big city in Virginia, then I thought, you know, I bet everybody, I bet many people in Richmond suffer from the after effects of tobacco. So I sort of did it on purpose, but then it gave me all these other ideas for, you know, what the characters can do.
Right, right. So there are a constellation of characters. There are some German men. There are this, Raina's boyfriend is black, and he's got his kind of posse of people that she feels a bit on the outside of. Last time on the show, we were talking about this new movement that is, I think it's called Own Voices, and this idea of cultural appropriation and what white writers are allowed to talk about, or, you know, what points of view white writers are allowed to take on. And I find myself really grappling with this issue lately. I can see both sides of it, and I'd love to get your perspective in so effectively writing fiction of how you feel about this issue of writing from not just other points of view, because I think that's a fiction writer's job, but I think it's dangerous if we say we don't have the right or authority to write from particular points of view.
I certainly thought about this when I was writing it, and there's one chapter that I threw out because I thought, you know, I don't know enough about this. I can't handle this. Mostly there are African-American characters, but it's not their point of view, but there's one character, Dereese, we are in her head. I have to say, many people have asked me the question that you're asking, not so much what I thought about it, but a lot of people say, you know, well, has anybody given you trouble about it?
Yeah.
So far, no one has directly given me trouble about it that I know about it. You know, I've looked to see if anybody wrote on Amazon about it. I haven't heard that. And I assume it's because, you know, the treatment is considered fair,
yeah,
and not resorting to stereotype, and the characters are not stereotypes; they're people. Of course, it's you know, it's something that we all think about. I didn't want to write about a world in which every single character is white. You know, I wanted there to be a larger world in this novel. So there's also Muslims in the novel, although we don't see them practicing, but that's, you know, what they're born into.
Yeah.
In the piece I'm working on now, I have Asians in the novel, you know. So I want a larger world in there. I live in New York, you know, I live with everybody. So, but I agree that handling is very delicate, and there may be a sense in which I'm not entitled to stuff. I just tried to be as careful as I could about that.
Right, and it really feels that way. And I really, it's actually when I got to the German characters that I was like, well, is that also part of this conversation? Like, are we given authority to write about the European point of view? And of course, it's from a man's point of view. And it just got me on this intellectual, you know, odyssey of what the core of that conversation is and how we grapple with it as fiction writers, because I think, you know, if you take it to its extreme, it would make a fiction writer's world very small. But I absolutely see the necessity of being very sensitive to issues that we have no idea about. And I don't know, I just think it's a very important conversation for fiction writers, because it really has a lot of ramifications about what we can and cannot do in fiction, or should and should not do in fiction. And
yeah.
I don't know that it's all played out yet.
No, it's playing out now,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah.
And we'll, you know, more things will emerge from it. There are only a few mentions of race as an issue in this novel. I mean, she's aware when she's with Boyd that she's sometimes the only white person in the room. And she also, when she thinks of Boyd, her boyfriend being in at Rikers, she thinks that her parents often indulge in smoking marijuana now and then, and nobody is stopping and frisking them, you know, on the streets of, they live in Boston. So there's some sense in which race is a factor in his incarceration. There's no question about that. But that's really the way it plays into the book, mostly, I think.
I think it also raises the issue of the world the book was born into. And when we talked in 2013, that book was written kind of during, I think you said at that time, 2008, when the financial crisis was going on.
Yes, yes, that's right.
And this book, you know, I assume was written kind of during the tail end of Obama's administration, and
yes,
we find ourselves
right.
where we find ourselves. And I wondered, you know, we had kind of an interesting conversation then about what was going on in your real world versus what was going on in your fictive world. And I wonder if you could speak to that in relation to this novel, what was going on, how the real world may have seeped into your subconscious as you were writing this fictive world.
Oh, that's so interesting. I'm sure it did. I'm sure I was writing, you know, I was writing during Obama's time as president, you know. So there were things I took for granted, which I certainly can't take for granted now. Yeah. I'm always aware of also the way Muslims are viewed, although I haven't written about that directly. But I knew that one thing that happened was I've been to Turkey 3 times. I love it as a traveler. But it changed very much in the popular imagination as I was revising the book.
Mm-hmm.
I don't go into it. I mean, I'm not an expert on Turkish politics, and I can't talk at length about Erdogan. But I was very aware that the rosiness in which I had viewed it as a romantic place for my character to be was going to have many qualifications as people read it. So I certainly tried to take that in.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit about, because I know you're a big traveler and travel has influenced a lot of these books that you've written, certainly this one, traveling as a writer and, you know, kind of, do you think you'd travel differently given that, you know, you may have in your mind that you're going to be rendering some of this to fiction or, you know, I know you've been to Turkey several times and maybe just how you, if you can separate the way you travel as a woman versus the way you travel as a writer. Does that make sense?
Sometimes I'm just traveling for fun, and I'm not thinking I'm ever going to write about anything. And I was just in Sri Lanka for 2 weeks, and it's fabulous, wonderful place. But I wasn't thinking of any way I was going to fold that in. And sometimes I'm very aware that I'm going to use something. I have a great story about China, which is 3 books ago. I knew that I wanted to write about missionary wives in China because I had read this great sort of account of a woman who ended up being killed in the Boxer Rebellion in 1900. So I wanted to use her report. And so that's a long time ago, right? So I'm going around China thinking, oh, you know, what can I still use and what's going to fold in? And I was in the city of Luoyang, which is sort of, you know, a big provincial city. And I had gone early in the morning to watch people practicing martial arts in the park. And this older guy came over to me and my companions and said, can I have my students practice their English with you? He was in his late 70s then, and he's had an American accent, which was then unusual for an older, you know, English-speaking Chinese person. And it turned out, he said, oh, you are a teacher. Have you heard of Oberlin College? And it turned out he had been taught by a later generation of the missionaries I was studying, you know, or trying to find out about for the story I wanted to write. So, in fact, he gave me different sources for the book, and I got even more, a larger sense of what to write about. I think it was exciting for both of us. He was just thrilled that I had heard of his people, and I was thrilled, you know, that he was some illustration of it. So occasionally that happens. That's the only time something, you know, a coincidence like that has ever taken me somewhere, but it was very thrilling.
That's so funny because we were talking about that last time on the show with Fools. There was, like, you were related to somebody in the, like, it was some great-grandfather.
Oh, yes, my friend Elspeth was related to Forster, who is Dorothy Day's, the father of her child. Yes, yes.
I love it when the universe says, you're doing the right thing. Keep going.
right. And I just grab whatever, you know, whatever information I can. Yes, I had forgotten that.
So that didn't happen with this book?
No, nobody was related to anybody or I didn't get extra information. Mm-hmm. I did I mean, the scenes that take place in Rikers, I was using because the nephew of a dear friend was in Rikers, and I visited him. So I actually did get to see, as a visitor, you know, see what you see at Rikers. And I think places like that, I mean, you know, they make such a deep impression. You know that it's going to find its way into something.
Right. My guest this morning is Joan Silber. The book is Improvement, and you are listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. So let's talk about some of these enduring themes that come up in this book and maybe that have come up in some of your other work, but this idea of improvement, this idea of trying to repair things that you have screwed up in your life, and the ability to kind of go back and try and recreate mistakes. Or not recreate mistakes, but repair mistakes. And I'm wondering if you finish the book and then you look back over it and you say, okay, that's what the book was about. I didn't know it when I was writing it. Or if, as you're writing it, you're like, this is a theme that I really want to work through. How much of it is your subconscious mind leading you through it? And then you look back and say, okay, now I have to revise it with these themes in mind.
In this case, I don't think I thought of the title until I was, you know, close to the end of the book. So it was definitely the first case you have presented. But I knew that I wanted the gesture that Raina makes to seem like an attempt at repair. I mean, there's plenty of things in life that we can't fix, but we can improve. And I realized that there were echoes, but I think some of the echoes I put in, the one where the character Monica, who's German, is involved in checking out the provenance of paintings to see if they were purchased, you know, through Nazi kind of, you know, appropriation of them. So I think I have to. I was putting in that was going to connect. And there's a few other, and the collecting insurance thing I wrote later, where the truck driver who's been in an accident is trying to collect his insurance, and of course that's for an accident, and of course that's another slightly more remote idea of you know, making or getting reparations. And I love the part where his wife says, you know, don't get too carried away about this because it's an unjust universe and you're not going to get what you think you deserve. And I think that after I read that, I thought, oh, that's the dilemma for the fiction writer, because it isn't, I'm not bringing any big news to anybody, right? It isn't a just universe, but you want to be able to depict moral action that has some sort of result. So I was certainly, that part I was consciously grappling with as I wrote.
Let's talk about some of these characters and rendering them and who was tough and who was surprising. Who gave you difficulty? There's such a constellation of big people, and we've talked about some of them. But anyway, tell me who was difficult and how you grappled with them, how you got into their head.
I think the truck driver was hard for me.
Uh-huh.
He's working class. He's a guy. And I don't drive. I live in New York. I have a license, but I haven't driven for many years. So I, of course, called my beloved out-of-state friends who know all about, you know, driving and insurance and accidents. And one of them had seen an accident with a truck driver, and she said he was almost in tears. So that sort of helped me get to the character a little bit. Often I write something badly and more cliched the first time. It's like your first layer of thought is the easier layer, you know? Mm. And then when I reread it, I particularized him more and was able to sort of use more. I have spent time upstate, so I knew what it looked like where he lived. But he was definitely a challenge to me.
Actually, to pause on him for just a moment. No, I don't want to interrupt you, but just before I lose my train of thought on this, I've been grappling with this idea of unlikable characters versus characters I don't care about. I've been getting this feedback sometime in my own fiction. I don't want my characters to be necessarily likable. I don't think that's their job, but you do want people to care about them.
Yes. Yes.
And I was wondering if you could talk about that, because he seems like a great example of somebody who I really cared about, and I, you know, I did not like him, But maybe that is the, maybe you're hitting on the point here of the first pass through is the easy pass through, and then you have to do the work to dig down to get to what makes us care about him, even if we don't necessarily like him.
Well, often, I'm not sure about him. I have to think about him more as you ask, but in a general way, suffering is what makes us care about a character, usually. If someone's having a hard time of it, our first instinct is to feel sorry for them. And sometimes, like, Chekhov can do beautiful things where he suddenly shifts and this person that you hated, you see as, you know, suffering in some way. So certainly that's important. I think what people have not liked about the truck driver character is that he's unfaithful to his wife, although he loves his wife. And I don't know that I find that such a lovable trait either, although he is not entirely, you know, he's not facile about it. He's not entirely forgiving of himself. I wanted a sense of him having made a mess of things. I mean, that, you know, his life hasn't been, you know, a smooth course either. So he has these complicated associations with his first wife, whom he didn't behave well towards because he was drinking heavily when they were young. It's funny, I don't think nobody wants to write a character they don't care about. I think that's a really interesting notion. We also, you want to make the details interesting, because you can write a dull character, which is easy for people to dismiss. And certainly with the German characters, that was the hardest, because those, I don't know those details as well. Right. I have friends who live in Berlin, and I quizzed their friends. We were all going out for coffee and cake at one point, and I said, "Well, so what was that neighborhood like? What was Kreuzberg like, you know, in this area, in this period of time? And what did you do?" And, you know, and that sort of gave me stuff I could use for people. I think details really help vivify stuff.
For sure, yeah. The thing that I think is difficult about writing from foreign characters' point of view, I mean, essentially we're all human and we all have, you know, human nature is what it is. But cultural things that get your focus, I think, are very, you know, obviously they grew up with different music and they grew up with a different political persuasion and they grew up with different values and all of that. All of that, I think, is really difficult to infuse into foreign characters. And I don't know anything about Germany, but I never forgot these men were German. Like, they always felt very German to me.
Oh, good. Oh, good.
I don't even know what that means, but
I err on the other side, usually. I tend to not emphasize, you know, the factors of difference. I think with Steffi, because we do know her mother, Monica, because we do know her mother later, I knew what kind of childhood she had had, so that sort of helped me, too.
Right. So there is one point of view character who is first person, the only point of view character who's first person, which I thought was really interesting because the whole novel is not, we start out thinking we're going to be in a first person novel, and that's not necessarily kind of how it unfolds. So talk about that decision to make one character first person and what it was like to work in that point of view versus the rest of the book.
Yes, because I'm used to working in first person. When I've done stories, I've mostly, although not always, used that. But when I think I wanted to just simply, you know, make it clearer that, okay, we're not with her anymore. So now we're in third person. And then, you know, for me, close third and first person aren't that different.
Yeah.
You know, once I sort of set foot in the he or the she, I'm okay. And it just seemed to make logical sense to do it that way.
I wanted to also highlight that she's an incredibly funny character. And I can't remember from your other novels if there was this much humor, but there were several times that I was laughing out loud with her. She just has the funniest voice to me.
Oh, good.
And I thought I don't know if you'd call it a device, but one thing that I can point out to our fiction writing audience is that you really effectively used parentheticals for humor with her. And I haven't, you know, that was very particular to her voice and her style. I haven't seen writers do that before, but I thought, have you used that in writing before, or was that invented for this particular character and her voice?
Say again what I use. I missed the phrase that you used for it.
Oh, well, that she has, there are all these parentheticals that she would kind of...
Oh, parentheticals, that's the word I'm missing. I have been accused of using parentheticals too much. But for, certainly for her, so it's not the first time I've used it, but certainly for her, it's where she gets her, to put in her comments, her often ironic comments about what's going on.
Right. Talk a little bit about voice, because her voice is, obviously, you have such a, as I keep saying, you have such a big constellation of characters here, and getting all of their voices very distinct. I mean, it you know, it feels like Joan Silber all the way through, but each of these characters, you can't mistake them for one another. And kind of getting the cadence of their voices and making them sound distinct from each other. How hard is that?
I'm trying to get what they say to themselves about what's going on, you know, the kind of phrasing they would use in their own mind about things. Maybe the parentheticals are really her talking to herself, in fact. So I am trying to get the phrases people would use without stylizing it too much. Again, I want to be really careful, you know, not to, to caricature people, whatever their, you know, locus is. But when I think of voice, I think of what they would say to themselves about what's going on, their internal voice.
Okay, okay. That's interesting. And when you write, did you write this kind of straight through, or do you stay with it? Like, because we see Steph at some point, for example, or we see Kiki at some point, for example, and then it's not until kind of the end of the book that we figure out what has happened to them. So tell me about when you know that as writer versus when you, you know, if, is it just a point of discovery as you're writing from point A to point Z, or do you kind of know their arc going into it?
I probably don't know, mostly. Sometimes within each piece, I know where it's going to end. I mean, I have some idea. I rearrange the chapters in this one. So, for instance, the truck driver chapter, which is, I think the third piece, or the fourth piece, was written after the other. So it was the last piece I wrote because I thought something was missing. So I do a certain amount of, you know, patching and pasting and shifting. But I was, in the other stuff, I was always writing toward the end.
Okay, okay. So the first chapter was its own standalone piece. Did that go through any revision, and it went out, and it was published? Did that go through any revision to make it kind of fit into the arc of the novel, or did it just remain what it was and kind of frozen in amber?
A few little pieces were added that I wouldn't have put in a story about her background. But not very much. Mostly it was, you know, the piece that was a story, you know, is pretty close to the novel chapter.
I love the beginnings and endings. So the novel begins, I don't think I'm going to give anything away with this, but the novel begins with "Everyone knows this can happen" is the first line. And the last line is "I knew it all along." And I think when fiction writers are trying to figure out how to wrap things up, you know, a lot of these chapters, I keep calling them stories, the chapters ended in a way that felt more like short story endings, you know, with a few loose ends kind of, you know, not tied up like novels so tend to do, which is why I love the short story form, because we're kind of left to our own imagination to see what happens.
Yes.
But then the novel resonance, because it's a novel as opposed to a short story, came back to the beginning. And I thought that was a really nice move. I don't know if that had to have been conscious on your part. I don't know where in the process the consciousness of that came from, but it felt very intentional.
Oh, I'm trying to think now. I think I would say half conscious might describe me in that respect.
And I'd also love to talk about writing sex, because I think that's really difficult for a lot of fiction writers. And you did it in such a, well, you know, it was, I'm trying to think if it was usually from the female point of view. I guess it wasn't. I guess it was from both points of view. But it did so nicely without kind of all the mechanics and clunkiness of sex, but it approached it, I think, from more of like a psychological, you know, how is this psychologically impacting the characters? And I wonder if you could give us some tips and tricks on whatever you've garnered from writing effective sex scenes.
obviously, I mean, sex comes into my fiction a lot, so it's obviously important to me as, you know, what the, you know, a part of the character's personalities. I think the key thing about sex is not literally what people do, because the mechanics of it are, you know, are known to all, but it's about character. So it's about what the character was feeling in that particular exchange more than the act itself. So I'm trying to get, you know, the feelings about it, the emotions about it, or the mark that it left on them or her or whatever, you know, as it's carried through. So it's the emotions of it more than the particulars, I think.
Yeah. How much revision do these chapters go through? I mean, is it pretty clean through the first time, or is it 8 drafts?
I'm the weirdest writer and the sort of worst example that way, in that I sort of revise every sentence as I go. So I'm always, you know, at the beginning of every day, I'm rewriting the paragraph that I wrote before. So and then when I come to the end, there's some sort of redrafting, but not that much. So they're kind of finished as I go along, except there's some stuff. So there's a lot of messing with it, no matter what. Yeah. It's imperfect at every stage.
So when you look across the kind of arc of your work, now that you've written, I think you've written 8 novels, I don't know, how old were you when you started writing?
Well, I've always written. Okay. You know, in first grade I was writing. but my first book was published when I was 34.
Okay. So over the course of those years, I'm wondering if you look back over that whole body of work and you see areas of concern that have endured and that you keep, you know, returning to, themes that you keep returning to, or if you see over the course of your time writing that your areas of concern have changed, or what you think about has changed, or if the world around you affects your fiction, kind of, you know, the global sweep across your body of work and what has endured and what has fallen away.
What a great question. I think I'm always writing about how somebody starts out shallow and gets, you know, more knowing by the end of the story.
Mm-hmm.
But they often start out, you know, shallow is probably frivolous in some way and get, you know, the world is more substantial than they knew. Certainly in... So whether that's, I mean, the first book's about a woman who's widowed, so she had no idea that that was going to happen. And then other books are often about a thinner social world that doesn't support what happens to the characters. As I've traveled more in the past 20 years, you know, the world has folded into my books, and I think they got larger through that. I got more involved as a kind of student of Buddhism, so in direct and quite indirect ways, I think that has come into the work and sort of relation to the self that's part of that kind of thinking. So that's, you know, it's more under the surface now, but it's definitely there.
Yeah. Yeah, and I was really taken by, I mean, the majority of your characters in this book are younger, they felt younger women kind of on the, I mean, when we first meet Kiki, she's, you know, in this real process of self-discovery. Certainly, Raina's in this process of self-discovery and emergence. And I love that perspective, the perspective of somebody maybe, you know, kind of wiser looking back on these poor women who, you know, I just feel sorry for women in their 20s in general.
Right.
But, yeah, you really rendered that, you know, kind of early stage of womanhood and, you know, all that pent up desire and, you know, what to do with men and what to do with these new children and all that kind of stuff that was really rendered well. And I don't know what drew you to that, you know, if it's kind of a, I don't know, looking back on life. You know, I don't know. I don't, what attracted you to her?
I'm interested in that phase of my own life, certainly, you know, where you, you know, you set your own fate by the kinds of decisions you make at that time. In this book, I wanted the older Kiki to be a kind of echo too, in a way that I maybe haven't used before. That she's someone at a later stage. So there's some balance.
There's so many great metaphors in here. I mean, the rugs and the tapestry of the rugs and, you know, things being woven together and enduring over time and fraying and all those wonderful metaphors. Raina is covered in tattoos, which I think is its own great metaphor. Tell me about the organicness of those metaphors, or if they kind of, you know, again, appear from the subconscious of your mind and you look back and say, oh, that was a good move, or, you know, or if they were really intentional all the way along.
Well, the rug on the cover, I feel, was such a lucky choice. I mean, I suggested it because the rug is a factor in the plot, and I have a couple of rugs, and nobody leaves Turkey without a rug. But because of the gorgeous rug being on the cover, reviewers tended to say, oh, these things connect, like the pattern of a rug. So they thought I was connecting on purpose, you know, also because in some ways I feel like the last four books I've done are part of a continuing project in some way. So people get what I'm doing. They don't think it's by mistake or by chance. They understand that, for better or worse, you know, it's on purpose. But I feel like the rug metaphor really served in that sense. And some of that was unconscious. I didn't know they were going to, you know, compare the book's pattern to the pattern of a rug. Right. What were the other things you asked me about?
And the tattoo. Well, I thought the tattoos were also really...
Oh, yes. Well, I'm surrounded, you know, I teach college kids, so I'm less so now than maybe 10 years ago, but I'm surrounded by kids with tattoos and great tattoos and really interesting ones. So the idea that you would, my friend's daughter, who has lovely artistic tattoos, I said to her once, like, aren't you afraid that, you know, you decide this and you have it forever? You know, I could never do that. And she said, I'll just say, you know, I was young. And I thought that was such an intelligent response to that question. So I was young once, is maybe how she put it. So it made me think about all of that, and I wanted to use that and also have that be as a point of contention between her and her aunt. Both Jews and Muslims have some, you know, rules against tattoos, although, of course, plenty of people do them anyway, and I'm sure there's, you know, different judgments on that. But I wanted to get that in there.
And I love, I always think it's such an advantage to live in New York as a writer. I don't know why, but I mean, you know, you just walk out your door and life is happening, unlike here in Irvine where, you know, you could walk for 2 miles and not see another person. But I don't know how much you think that your life in New York has kind of informed the writer you are, or how much you feel. I mean, I don't even know if one could tell if, you know, where they live and how they live informs who they are. But New York just seems like such a, I don't know, rich, wonderful advantage to a writer.
I certainly think so. I love my city. And every time I come home, I'm just like so happy to be here. And certainly the one thing that New York stands for is multiplicity. Whatever else, you know, you can say about us, we have a lot of everything. And I guess, you know, that's an impulse in my writing, too. I'm trying to get in lots of stuff.
Yeah, yeah. Do you feel like the external noise of the world right now, speaking of, you know, distraction, influences your or impacts or inhibits your writing? Is it harder for you now in the past couple of years of noise to write? I hear this a lot from writers and wonder how accomplished writers kind of get through this, shut out the outside world. And endure.
Noise in the sense of what's
political
happening politically,
yeah,
around us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't know if it certainly made me feel that I'm, you know, I would like to think that my writing is in some way, you know, an act of resistance, although that's, you know, maybe exaggerating what it can do. No, I don't know if it's made it harder, but it's made me more aware. It's made me less casual about what I can take for granted.
Do you find it influencing what you're working on?
I'm not sure it has, actually. I have to think about that. I don't have a ready answer. I'm certainly not writing directly about political threats,
right.
But I'm very aware day to day, you know, what I live in.
It's probably one of these things that you can't really see until, you know, it's 20 years of hindsight and you can say, ah, you know, I think we talked about that the first time with the book Fools, that you wouldn't necessarily have really known that it was being so impacted by the 2008 financial crisis and Bernie Madoff and all of that. But as it finished, then you'd say, of course, that was going on. And, you know, maybe what we're living through now is going to be another echo of that. I don't know. It's interesting.
I think that's right. Yeah. That's right.
Yeah. My guest this morning is Joan Silber, and the book is Improvement. You are listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. Last time when we were talking about advice, we had to, I ran out of time, and I wanted to come back to this because I had never heard your advice last time was to cultivate equanimity in your life. I wanted to unpack that a little bit more because I think it's important, and especially right now I think it's even more important than maybe when we talked 5 years ago, and I hadn't really heard that advice before, so I'd love to hear more about how you do that, why you do that.
I think I originally said that because I've had my career trajectory is like a giant pretzel. You know, I've had many twists and turns and ups and downs. And I had 13 years in between book two and book three where I had trouble getting a book published. Every writer's life has defeats. I mean, even if we look at writers, we think of nothing but success. You know, it didn't feel that way to them. So if you don't have equanimity, you're not going to move forward. You're just going to moan. So, and even now that things are so good for me, I feel the need for that. I think it has to do with perspective, too. I mean, whatever is going on, it's not the end of the world. It's, your particular, happiness or unhappiness is a part of, something larger. So I guess that's what I mean by it when I say that.
Is it difficult now that this novel has done so? Well, I mean, you've written so many novels, so I imagine the answer is no. But to write in the aftermath of success, or to see, that this novel really hit people on all cylinders, and then you sit down at the blank screen again, everything's new again, and kind of how you get up for the next time.
I know I'm going to get up.
Yeah.
I know at this point. One thing that you have as a writer is habits. So I don't have doubts about my returning to the process, even when I'm having a hard time. Certainly, the stuff I'm working on now has been quite difficult, and I think I'm going to discard some things that I've written and try to enter the material at a different point. But I regard that as normal. I just think that's a normal part of the process. Is that what you're asking about?
Am I answering
the question you're asking?
You are. And actually, to that point, I wonder if you could talk a little bit about when you know something needs to go. I think a lot of writers have a hard time throwing things away, and they get, kind of married to things. And a minute ago you mentioned this kind of a lull in your publishing life and how long it took you. And I guess this just comes through practice of knowing when you need to let something go. But how do you know when something isn't working, when it's time to abandon it?
I think it takes time. I think I don't know. And even the pieces I'm talking about now, I may be able to rework them and use the parts of them that I like. But I think only through time. Because when you finish something, you think it's fine usually. You're happy to be done.
Yeah.
Also, I do work in pieces. I mean, even whether it's chapters or stories, they're separate, so that might make it easier for me.
Yeah. I love that you've been compared multiple times to Alice Munro. You're the America's Alice Munro. I can't imagine a better compliment.
I'm so thrilled to hear that. Also, I always feel like she has many, admirers, but she doesn't have that many acolytes. There aren't that many people who would consider themselves followers of her. And I really do. I feel like I learned, we're very different. And comparisons are dangerous. I wouldn't, But I mean, she's so good, too. It's, you don't want to compare yourself to someone who's, such a stellar personality and figure. But I think that I really learned a huge amount from her about how to handle time, about character, about the deep pockets of a story. So I'm thrilled when anybody compares me to her.
I do think, and I need to think about this more, but I was reading recently about your thoughts on her, of what a short story can do in terms of expansion of time. And I think I need to go back and study both of you a little bit more to see how exactly that's accomplished. But this idea that, I don't know if it's through linked short stories or if you can just do this in a single short story, but you can accomplish more span of time almost than you can in a novel. And I need to kind of unpack that and think about how you do that. But if you have any if you have any quick insights on that, that'd be wonderful.
Well, what she does, I'm in some ways more comfortable talking about her that way, is she's getting the whole lifetime of a character in a story. So often you've seen, you move around, oh, the character was young, no, she's older, no, she's young again. So all of a sudden, by the time you get to the end, you realize you've got the whole shape of a character's life. They're kind of biographical stories in a zigzagging way. She zigzags much more than I do. But I think that's part of, I think the compression that's involved in a story, even though there's such long rambling stories from her, is part of what gives you a sense of long time covered. She's able to do that.
Yeah, because she didn't really work in the linked story form. I can't think of any examples. I mean, all of her stories are pretty standalone.
Well, she has two books, Lives of Girls and Women, which was the first book of hers I read. I guess it's her second book. And there's one that is subtitled Stories of Flo and Rose, and I think it was called The Beggar Maid in this country. Okay. It has a better title in Canada. It was something like Who Do You Think You Are? Okay. But those are linked stories. Those are about characters who recur, but they're quite separate. And I think we're published quite, they're more freestanding than we might think of linked stories as sometimes being.
Are there other writers that have influenced you like that, or that you recommend to listeners to kind of get the cadence?
There are plenty of other writers that I love. I like David Malouf, who's an Australian writer we don't hear about too much. Uh-huh. I like Colm Tobin, who I think is wonderful. I love The Master. I always teach that. Uh-huh. I like Lauren Groff's stories I love in recent time. So there's plenty of people, but I think the influence, it's late for me to be influenced by people. But, I absorbed most of those sort of traces when I was younger.
Yeah. So the advice that you left us with last time was cultural equanimity, or cultivate equanimity. Is there other things that you tell writers? I know you've been teaching for a long time. Are there things you tell your students that particularly help them through?
Well, I think, I feel I sometimes have to, this sounds like an odd thing to emphasize, but the way people learned how to write before there was any such thing as, teaching writing in colleges was reading intensively. And really, reading something over and over and over and absorbing as closely as possible, which is why, the annotated editions, of books by famous writers are later valuable. So I think people have to be retold to do that, to read with that kind of, voracious intensity.
Yeah, that is funny you should say that, because that advice came up just a couple of weeks ago on the show, that people generally tell writers to read broadly and to keep reading, and somebody else brought this up, that no, what you really should do is, well, you should do that too, but you should also just study one piece of great fiction to see exactly how they did it, and reread as much as read broadly, but reread the classics, I think, is equally important. And I think it is easy to skim through things thinking that, okay, well, I've read a lot, but I haven't read deeply. And reading deeply, I think, is a really important value to writers, to learn exactly how these things are accomplished. That's great.
It's actually what I like about teaching, because I always, although I'm mostly reading student manuscripts, I also have them read, a few texts that I like. And I love that, because I have to read them so much more carefully when I'm teaching them, and I learn so much by doing that.
Yeah. How long have you been teaching?
Since I've been teaching fiction writing since 1985.
That's great.
I taught freshman comp for a few years before that.
Do you see trends, or do you see things changing over time, over the course of your teaching, in terms of, the quality of writing coming out? It seems like the quality of writing has just gotten better and better, to me, from coming out of programs.
I think the quality has gotten better. I think that's true. I see more, people have more varied tastes, which I like. There were some years where minimalism was in the 80s, so it's going back a ways. In the 80s and 90s, minimalism was such a dominant mode that it tended to want to, you know, discredit other modes. And I don't see that anymore. I think people are able to like all different kinds of writing. I see more non-realistic writing, you know, various kinds, whether it's speculative fiction or, you know, dystopian fiction or just strange and weird things in stories, folkloric elements, you know, and I like that. I like seeing it.
Yeah, I like that too. Joan Silber, we're out of time, but this was wonderful. And you, we can find you online. It's your name, Joan Silber, SILBER.net, I think is, and it's got all the information on all of your books and I think a couple of interviews and things like that up there as well. Huge pleasure. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you so much. I enjoyed this tremendously. Thank you.
That was Joan Silber. The book is Improvement. It is out and available now. Huge, huge treat. That's all the time we have for today. We will be right back here with you next Wednesday morning. So until next time, thanks so much for joining us and have a great, great day.